This message is part of the educational ministry of Columbia International University. We've been preparing world Christians to know Him and to make Him known since 1923.
I've got Dr. Jones' Bible, so if I start speaking a different language, you know it's because of all the power that emanates from his Bible. I feel smarter already. Let me read from you a couple verses. Luke chapter 10, starting with verse 25. And behold, a certain lawyer stood up and put him to the test, saying, "Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" And he said to him, he being Jesus, "What is written in the law? How does it read to you?" And this lawyer answered and said, "You shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart and all of your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." And he said to him, "You shall have answered correctly. Do this and you will live." But wishing to justify himself, as you know how lawyers are, he said to Jesus, "Who is my neighbor?" Jesus replied and said, "A certain man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho." Anyway, you know the rest of the Jericho Samaritan story. What happens? It's a pretty common story. What you may not know is that the Samaritans and the Jews hated each other, and there's still a village of Samaritans, around 800 or some odd people, that still exist. But these people hated each other as much as any Islamic fundamentalist and Jewish fundamentalist today. So these weren't just neighbors in the ordinary sense. They were bitter, bitter enemies. Now, you flip back to the Beatitudes in Matthew chapter 5, and it really takes on more symbolism to me because I was sitting on the Sea of Galilee with my wife, Mary Wood, just a matter of weeks ago, and it's just an incredible scene knowing that you're where Jesus was delivering this great sermon, and hear these words when Jesus said in the 43rd verse of chapter 6 of Matthew, "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy.' But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you." A buddy of mine, I don't know how many of you saw Why Do You Fear Me? Any of you saw Why Do You Fear Me the other day on the webinar Thursday night? We were, in fact, putting on the webinar called Why Do You Fear Me? And we had 57 countries participating, thousands of people from all over the world watching this webinar. But you may have gotten to, if you watched it, you saw a guy named Carl Medeiros, who sat to my left, Ted Decker, the author, who's written 25 novels, fiction, brutal stuff. I said, "Ted, I don't read your stuff." He said, "Well, that's brutal stuff, killer suspense and mystery." And then he has Christian books like Tea with Hezbollah, which just came out the other day, and I highly recommend it. But Carl, who's on my left, this guy is a really interesting guy. He has dedicated his life to the Islamic world. And Carl, if you know him, and we both got a lot of stories that we share where our lives have been at gunpoint, here and there. He's got better ones than I do, but this is typical Carl. He's in Iraq during the midst and the height of all the problems. He drives into the middle of this one so-called conservative militant city and just gets out of the car and says, "Where's your leader? Where's the leader?" And if you know anything about the world of Islam, it's basically tribal. And they're like, and he speaks Arabic, this is Carl does, and they take him to their leader, the number one guy in the city, the mullah. And Carl goes up to him and says, "I'm looking for Jesus." And said, "You're looking for Jesus?" He says, "Yes, have you seen him here?" And this Sunni Muslim says, "Maybe the better question is, if Jesus were here, what would he want us to do?" And Carl smiled and said, "Yes, that is a good question." And they agreed that we should be helping the children and the widows. And then Carl said, you know, it's better off for me, for you, that if we're enemies. And the mom says, well, you want to explain that one to me? Because this guy has the authority to just whack him right there. He said, yeah. He says, when you read in the Gospels, the Injils, by the way, a holy book, if you're a Muslim, the Injils, the Gospels. He said, yeah, if you're my enemy, Jesus tells me I have to love you. And the mullah says, well, an enemy you are. And they hugged each other, embraced. And he told everybody in the city, he said, whatever this man wants and whatever this man wants to do, you give it to him. Because he is here in the name of Jesus, of Isa el Messiah. Talk about brave. Crazy, of course. But was not Jesus radical when he tells you to love your enemy? I was sitting on the hillside, it's during the Kosovo War, in one of the refugee camps in 1999. If you remember, the Kosovo War was a brutal war, an ethnic cleansing war, whereby those in the name of God, Christian Orthodox, were ethnically cleansing those Muslims in Kosovo. And I watched the news thinking it just can't be quite as bad as they're portraying on CNN. This was typical of news media, sensationalize this type of atrocity, but it really probably just limited in sphere, and they're trying to, you know, they didn't have any big story this year, so this is it. So I decided I would go and see for myself, only to find out that it was much worse than any newscast in the West, whether it was Europe or the United States. Watching people in the name of God, brutally, in our name of our Christian God, ethnically cleansing people. I was sitting on the hillside this one particular afternoon. We had been working all day and all night. Brutal stories. This little boy, he was sitting by me. As you can imagine, my Albanian language was not too well. I could speak just a few words, like you can imagine. Hello, how you doing? Or I love you, things like that. And I asked this little 11-year-old kid who was sitting beside me, and his father was on the other side. And the little kid spoke fairly good English. But his broken English, we could tell the story. I said, tell me how you got here. And most of the people in this refugee camp were lawyers and doctors and plumbers and electricians and professional teachers and political leaders. These were people just like you would see here. And he told the story about how he and his little sister, 8-year-old sister, and his father and mother had fled Pristina. Pristina is the town, the city that was in brutal civil war, of which I'll be there in about 2 months with some former leaders, which another day we'll talk about. But the little boy told the story how they had fled from ditch to ditch, tree to tree, forest to forest, trying to get to where we were, across the border in Macedonia, where they would have freedom and safety, some freedom, some liberty, but safety. And they made it within about a half a mile of the border. And a half a mile of the border, beautiful as it is, something like you'd see in The Sound of Music, with the rolling hills and just fabulous God's creation, and their landmines all along the border. And so Dad slows down the family as he takes the lead, looking for the landmines half a mile away, seeing Friedman and a sniperman, one of Milosevic's snipermen, spot them. And you can imagine you got a sniperman probably a half a mile, quarter mile behind you. You got landmines all around you, trying to move your family through. And you're trying to move quickly, but not recklessly. It's a delicate situation. Mom's in the back. And Mom hits a landmine, and naturally when this happens, you turn around with a little girl who was right in front of Mom. When she turns around, the sniper rifleman shoots the little girl, 8-year-old girl, kills her. The father, how he did this, I don't know, but he grabs the 11-year-old boy and slams him to the ground, and they crawl, leaving their child and wife behind, making it to where we were so that we could take them in. And this old, I would say around here, old country fella, didn't have much knowledge, much education, came up to me in his cane, and he could tell that I was bewildered by the entire situation of which I was. I thought I was a very sophisticated guy. I was a former governor, a lawyer, background in microbiology, well-studied, well-versed in the history around the world and culture. I thought I knew a pretty good bit about life, but I was sitting there with all my knowledge and education very befuddled. And this old man, somehow he knew it. And he walks up to me, he says, "You don't understand, do you?" And I shook my head, sitting there on the ground, having not but a little bit of sleep in the last 48 hours. And I said, "No, sir, I really don't understand." And he explained to me in this little sentence what every commentator, theologian, academician couldn't explain to me, given the geological, geographical, theological, cultural position where I was at that moment in time. He said, "This is where the East and the West don't meet." I said, "That was the most powerful thing theologically, geographically, that had been said about this entire chaos." And I began to think, two dynamic cultures of Islam, Western Christianity, and where we were situated. And I can tell you dozens of more stories that would horrify you. Neighbors killing neighbors and children, and I mean, gunpoint, unbelievable. Well, I thought, what can I do to make a difference? Do we have different theology between Muslims? Yes, we do. Does that mean we should hate them because of a few terrorists? Jesus says to love your enemy, pray for those who persecute you. That's a hard thing to do sometimes. Are all Muslim terrorists? At that point, when I came back, a group of us began to get together, one particular guy named Henry Dineen, who's now head of Greater European Mission, which has a formal relationship with CIU. He was my general counsel as governor. And Henry and I had a heart for a part of the world that we knew America was having problems with. So I was viewing this as a Christian. And I say a Christian, I don't mean a Western cultural Christian, because I want to, we might talk a little bit about that if we have time, but as a follower of Jesus. And I'm defining Christian in this sense as me as someone who follows Jesus, not too good at it, but following Jesus as opposed to just being a Western Christian. Because a Western Christian from a Muslim perspective really isn't that good. In fact, let me just tell you this. I had a friend, one of the most sophisticated female leaders in the Middle East, was telling a friend of mine in a conversation how disappointed she was about America and how upset she was about America. And my friend said, "There's a lot of Christians in America that pray and love Jesus." And she said, "I don't think there's a single Christian in the United States that even knows Jesus." Powerful indictment. Such vast misinformation from both sides of the world. And so Henry Dineen and I began to talk. Henry, what can we do? There's so much misinformation. I have so much misinformation. And so we created the Center for Global Strategies to begin to engage the world of Islam. And so whether you're talking about the Middle East or Europe, Eastern Europe, North Africa, that was basically began our focus. Not to go and be tricky or cute or sly, but to truly go build relationships, bridge the gap between East and West, learn more about them, and they learn more about us. And so one of the first things we did was in creating the Center for Global Strategies, we decided we would do a major international conference, for example. Our first one would be in Tunisia. Now, this is pre-9/11. Someone would ask me, "What are we doing in the Middle East?" And I would say, "Well, we're reaching out to Muslims." Why? Pre-9/11, that was a common question. Why? You try to explain it, and they're like, "Oh, okay. Well, post 9/11, I get it. You know, you don't have to explain it. Well, we had made the decision to do a major international conference in Tunisia, a fairly moderate Muslim country. And here's how it would go. I would fly in, you know, the big former governor from the state, from the United States would come in, and I'd have my team that's on the ground, like Henry Dineen and others. And we would begin meeting with leaders of the country saying we're willing to put on a major economic conference, an international conference on economic policy from around the world, and we'll do it here for free. And here's what we'll do, and here's what we expect you to do. Well, I do that, create the aura that this is real, because otherwise if you walked into a leader, the president of a country, or the minister of economy or tourism or whatever, they were like, well, who are you? You know, I mean, who are you? What resume do you have to? And so I would sort of give this aura that they're credible, and then I would fly on back. Well, then Henry and the team, guess what? You know how many meetings it takes to have an international conference of speakers from all over the world? Dozens upon dozens and dozens. Well, the first two, three, four meetings, you're talking about logistics and speakers, who's paying for this, who's paying for that, all these kind of things. Well, about the fourth meeting, you're going to lunch afterwards. And guess what happens at lunch? How many kids you got? Oh, yeah, I got two kids. What's their names? You find out that they do the same thing as your kids. Well, discussion eventually goes to your faith. And we do not hide at all our faith. 9/11 hit before we had the conference, and the Tunisian leadership called and said, we assume we're canceling the conference because nobody was flying internationally at this point in time. And we said, no, this 9/11 only makes our case that why we should be there. And they cried. They couldn't believe that we were willing to come. And we would do the conference and the speeches and all this kind of stuff. And that's good because Jesus says, blessed are the peacemakers. I'm there as an American trying to be a peacemaker, as a Christian trying to be a peacemaker and loving my enemy. And that in itself is good. And we're teaching them things that I believe that are very important on economic market principle and a lot of other things, how you do that. How do you develop economy and these kind of things. Good things. But after the great speeches, except for mine, and all these other things, we have lunch, and I always insist on a tour. And on the buses and at the lunches, when somebody will say, well, Governor, we really appreciate y'all coming, but y'all are different. Y'all aren't the average American. And I'll say, no, we are the average American. What you see in your Islamic propaganda is sometimes the same kind of garbage we see about you. One particular, after one major conference, I had one of the leaders say, you know, Governor, did you realize that that Jesus is in the Quran? And at this point, I'd never read the Quran. I said, really? He said, yeah, Isa al-Masih. I said, Jesus is in the Quran. I said, well, he said, yeah. He said, over 100 times. I said, over 100 times? He said, did you know that Jesus was born of the Virgin Mary? I said, that's in the Quran? He said, yeah. He said, we have an entire chapter on Mary. Do y'all have an entire chapter on Mary? I said, no, Catholics might, but we don't. He said, yeah, we believe that Jesus was born of the Virgin Mary, performed miracles, was without sin, was the holiest prophet of all prophets, was the Word of God. We believe that He's in heaven right now, and He's coming back on Judgment Day. I said, you do? I can't believe this. Now, obviously, there's a lot of confusion, theologically speaking, from the Islamic world about Jesus. We don't see Jesus the same way. Is it the same Jesus? Yes, it is. It's just that they don't see Him quite like we do. But the fact is, like Paul, talk about an opportunity. I mean, walk up to a Muslim and say, let me tell you why the Quran is wrong, and let me tell you why Muhammad is wrong, and let me tell you why you won't get listened to for 15 more seconds. But when I'm sitting, and it happened a few weeks ago when I'm in Saudi Arabia, 2 weeks ago, it happened a month and a half ago when I was in Saudi Arabia, because our conversations, everyone knows that we're there as Christians, as followers of Isa al-Masih, to love our enemy. and we do business together. We're putting together major business opportunities now. And every night, and by the way, they do dinner, like in Saudi Arabia, a very conservative country, as you well know, the Wahhabis, et cetera. We meet with the leaders, the sheikhs, et cetera. And they'll start eating about 11 o'clock at night. You know, I'm like, I'm 2 hours past my bedtime. And at 1 o'clock is when you start talking. And you do. And that's where the conversation obviously leads to politics, and I lead it straight to Jesus. Straight to Jesus. You know, I don't convert anybody. I don't save anybody. And if you think you do, you're really missing something here. But if you can carry a conversation with a Muslim to Jesus, because there's incredible rich opportunity to go to their book, a historical book that 1.5 billion people read, and you and I might not agree with all of it, but it is based upon, in general, Judaism and Christian faith. You need to study Islam a little bit more. There's a lot of bad information about there. There's a lot of Muslims who don't know the Quran. There's a lot of mullahs who are, just like some historically in Christianity, have created wars in the name of God, have interpreted, twisted what Jesus and God have said in the Bible for war. But the opportunity is there, it's ripe, to reach out to Muslims in the name of Isa al-Masih and Jesus the Messiah. Because one of their holy books, you got the Quran, the Hadith, you got the Torah, you've got the Psalms, and you got the Injils, the Gospels. And it's so easy to take a Muslim and say, yes, the Injils, the Gospels. In the Quran, it says that the Gospels are true, that Jesus is this great prophet. And there's some technical differences, and they're very important differences. We can get to all that later. Let's find that common ground and move them to, you know, go to the Gospels. And the Quran says to read the Gospels. The Gospels are true, and that Jesus is a holy prophet. Therefore, why don't you read about Jesus? Can you give me this book? Can you give me one of the Gospels? Yes, I can, here. Oh, thank you so much. And I said, why don't we commit today together to following Jesus? Okay. Now, have they gotten to that point you and I want them to? Maybe not that day. Maybe not be in my presence. But you know, God has a way of doing things. We have Muslims, and this is a controversial debate, and it's usually from people who aren't over there. I have some Muslim friends who are followers of Jesus and maintain their cultural Muslim identity. At first, I had a problem with it, and I'm not going to theologically debate it because I'm not a theologian. But I've met some Muslims who follow Jesus to the cross and in their life, and they know the Quran, and they know the scriptures, and they follow Jesus unlike anybody I've seen in the West. Remarkable testimonies, powerful stories. And if you heard Samir Khadi, this particular leader, you would be amazed at the stories that he has. This Sunni Muslim from Lebanon, living half of his life in Saudi Arabia, can talk to the mullahs about the Quran and how it points to Jesus and how they can more fully submit to God as a Muslim. Submit to God. Does anybody have a problem with submit to God? How about the word Allah? If you'd asked me a few years ago about the word Allah, I would have gotten bent out of shape. You want to get your little life a little bit upside down a little bit, go study the history of the word Allah, and you'll find out that the Germanic, arguably the pagan Germanic word G-O-D, may have less credibility. This is a discussion of debate. But the point is, you and I believe in God. Arabic is Allah. It was used by the Christian Palestinians and the Christian Arabs before Muhammad came on the scene 600 years later. And the Arabic Christian materials is Allah. It took me a while every now and then it still catches. Why? Because you've been culturally sensitized by these radicals, these Muslim radical terrorists A month and a half ago, and this was a hard pill to swallow, terrorist organizations like, let's say, Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah. Everybody here has heard of Hezbollah, I'm sure. CIA and State Department people cringe when we do this, I can assure you that. But in the south of Lebanon is where Hezbollah operates. If you're from the south of Lebanon, you see Hezbollah as freedom fighters. If you live a few miles across the border on the Israeli side, which was Lebanon territory only a matter of years ago, by the way, they're terrorists. So I'm meeting with the number one guy in charge of all military covert and other operations for Hezbollah. Think it's tense? You can imagine. A couple fears. Get blown up. Obviously, they're not going to blow up his own guy, but what if the Israeli defense finds out, because they are tracking our cell phones, that we're meeting with the number one guy? So, okay, well, we'll lose our governor, but whatever, we're getting the number one guy. We met for several hours, and guess what our number one conversation was? And I asked hard questions, believe you me. Jesus. Jesus. Did we have an impact? I don't know. I think God did. What'll happen from that? I don't know. But I pray for him, because that same soul, just like mine, needs a loving God. We're out there trying to make a difference, opening up doors. We've done conferences. Yemen. I mean, we've been in Yemen 4 or 5 times. You read about Yemen lately, because that's where a lot of Al-Qaeda training takes place. And I could give you story after story after story in Yemen. We had a delegation, by the way, from Yemen that came to the United States, of the leaders, business and government. And guess where we took them? Most of these leaders, guess what, had already studied in Berkeley, New York University, spent years in the United States in these major cities. But they'd never been where? To the south, to the heartbeat of America, rural America, you know, God's corner. So anyway, they're here for about a week, and these are very sophisticated, wealthy, sharp individuals. And we take them to the port, universities and this and that, have suppers and dinners and this type of thing, and we have them at the farm, and I take them four-wheel riding and this kind of stuff, and they're having a blast. And the last dinner is at our farm, at our, what we call our pool house, which is a really neat place, and wood-shaped roof, a giant porch wrapping around it, and kind of wood siding, and it's real rustic back in the woods with waterfalls on the backside. It's kind of a neat place. It's a God place kind of thing. And so it's time for them to say goodbye and, you know, say, hey, we've had a wonderful time. And they said all that kind of stuff. But here was the most telling thing. They said, Governor, most of us, as you know, have studied here. We spent years in the United States, but we never saw the real America until we came down here. Y'all have shown us the love of God. He said, if every Muslim in the world could see what we've seen and experienced this week, there would never be war between our peoples. What did we do? We just reached out to our enemy in love. Now, that doesn't mean we still don't have our military. We still don't guard our shores and the things that we must do. But as individuals, and we can debate that politically and theologically, but individually, Jesus says to love your enemy, pray for those who persecute you. So next time you see a Muslim, you've got an opportunity to love him. And what I have found is that there are always going to be extremists in all faiths. And in the Islamic world, there certainly are some problems. There certainly are some theological differences. But I have found that the average Muslim, given a chance, will love you and share a peaceful life with you. And then they can stand up stronger against the militants when they tell lies about you. And who knows, you share your life stories with one another, they too may come to know the Jesus as God really intended for that relationship to be. I know we're out of time. It's a great experience and opportunity for me to be here. I ask you to consider how you will engage the unsaved, the unreached. What can you do after you leave here? Go to whydoyoufearme.com and watch the webinar we did the other night. Watch part of it. It's 90 minutes. You're not going to watch all of it. I know that. But there's a lot of information there. And then go to www.iwillbeafriend.com. I will be a friend. And it's a movement that we're hoping that will kick out there and reach out to other cultures and learn more about other cultures. We're going to have blogs and dialogues going, Muslims and Christians, and, you know, who knows where it'll go. Now, we don't always agree. Carl Medeiros, I don't agree with him on everything, but boy, he's a lot of fun to be with. And by the way, the book, Tea with Hezbollah, I would get it. It's a great story. And I think his simplest book, Christians, Muslims, and Jesus, you won't necessarily agree with all of it theologically, but that's okay. Christians, Muslims, and Jesus is a very easy read to get a basic understanding of, and he's not a universal, don't get me wrong, this guy is a true Jesus, but he gives the common ground to bring Muslims and Christians together, and that we all hopefully will follow Jesus as God wants us to do, to go to the cross and be saved from our sins and to follow Jesus, loving God with all our heart and all our mind and our soul, loving Abraham. How do you do that? Follow him. It really is that simple. Don't let all these extra books get you confused. I tell a lot of my friends, that's great, read those things. Books about the Bible, that's great, that's wonderful. I said, but don't ever let any of that ever take the place of going to the gospel and reading what Jesus said. Every day, go back to the simplicity of what Jesus said. Not what he said about Jesus. What did Jesus say? Love your enemy. God bless you, and thank you for letting me be with you.
We hope you were blessed by this message. Additional audio messages and learning resources are available at www.ciu.edu/bookstore or call 803-807-5263. Messages are also available by podcast at iTunes. CIU is a regionally accredited biblical university offering undergraduate and graduate degree programs. Our purpose is to educate people from a biblical worldview to impact the nations with the message of Christ. Thank you for letting us minister to you today.